Well, good morning, everybody. I appreciate everybody hanging in here. I know we've covered a lot of stuff this morning, but we're also going to be covering our study in the Word of God, and that's a pretty important thing. It's something that we have always placed a high emphasis on, a premium on, and something we'll continue to keep doing. I believe wholeheartedly. And if we can get into this word and find out what it is that God is speaking to us through this word, that it will change us. It'll change the world around us. So we've taken a break from our study in the Gospel of Mark over the holidays, but we're coming back this morning. We're in the final act of Mark's very dramatic narrative of the Gospel. And if you've got a Bible or a Bible app and you want to follow along, if you'll find your way to Mark 14, please. It's probably, you know, since it's been a while, it's probably a good idea for me to give you a little bit of a quick refresher on where we are in this story. When we left off last time, remember Jesus and his disciples had come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, as everyone would do at that time to celebrate it in Jerusalem. And while he was there and actually celebrating the Passover with his disciples, Jesus dropped a bombshell on them and let them know that one of their own was going to betray him into the hands of the authorities who were looking for him, who were plotting for a way to destroy him because of his popularity and the threat that he posed to those who were in power at that time. And so he told them that one of them was going to betray them. And then a little later on, he said, by the way, actually, all of you guys are going to desert me at some point, and even identified Peter as someone who's going to deny that he even knew him. And of course, Peter and the other disciples set out to correct Jesus and explain to him that he just didn't understand how loyal and how faithful they really were. And so there's nothing to worry about. But later, Jesus is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Judas shows up with a mob of, it says a mob, but it's a group of temple guards, servants of the high priest and Roman soldiers, and they arrest Jesus. And when this happened, Peter, because of his bravado and his great faith, became a one-man assault team. He pulled a sword, he jumped into the crowd and started a melee, but Jesus put a stop to that, told him not to do that. And then as Jesus is arrested, all of his followers, all of his disciples slip off into the night, just as he said they would do. And that's where we left off. That's where the drama is. There's a lot of stuff happening here, a lot of important things. That's our setting. Is the arrest of Jesus, the initial arrest of Jesus. And now we're going to be reading about Jesus' trial before the Jewish leaders, the Sanhedrin. And this morning, this is going to be another Markian sandwich. What I mean is there's going to be a main event that is flanked by two accounts of Peter's experiences in the courtyard. The main event is Jesus' trial, flanked by Peter on either side of that. And in this trial, we're going to see on display some of the worst motivations for religion and social interaction, things like pride and hatred and fear. And all of that's going to be contrasted with this quiet and confident testimony that Jesus gives before those who are questioning him. This section is dramatic. Many scholars consider it to be a unique example of a very sophisticated writing style for the ancient world. It's marvelous. I love every part of this, and I get too excited because I want to just drill down on everything, but we're going to step back and we're going to take an overview and see what we can learn from this, what gets revealed to us in the midst of this trial. So if you're in Mark 14, we're going to pick up where we left off last time, starting with verse 53. It says, they took Jesus to the high priest's home where the leading priests and elders and the teachers of religious law had gathered. Meanwhile, and I love that the NLT puts that in there because that's just like a comic book at that point. But meanwhile, Peter followed him at a distance and went right into the high priest's courtyard. There he sat with the guards warming himself by the fire. And we got to stop here for just a moment because this is the top piece of bread to our sandwich. It's accounting for Peter's location in this. And it's something that we're going to come back to after this first trial here. The temple guards who arrested Jesus, they take him to the high priest's home. We know that this is Caiaphas at that time, the son-in-law of Annas. And the religious leaders are all gathered there waiting for him. So this isn't, you know, a big surprise. This is something that they were planning, putting together, anticipating to do. But we get this detail here of Peter slipping into the courtyard, trying to blend in. And we've got to wonder, what is he doing there? Like, I don't know. I mean, besides trying to keep warm at the fire, why is Peter there? Like, what was he thinking? We know that in the Garden of Gethsemane, he grabs a sword and he's ready to take everybody on. Is he thinking that he's going to try to rescue Jesus at this point? He's going to be like little John rescuing Robin Hood from the Sheriff of Nottingham. Was he just there to see how this all was going to pan out, where it was going to go from here? I strongly suspect Peter didn't know why he was there. I think Peter was just so used to following Jesus wherever he went that he just kept on doing it. Even in this situation, he kept doing it even after Jesus was arrested. Now, we take note, he wasn't doing it well. I mean, he kept a safe distance between the two of them, and he does his best to try to blend in with Jesus's captors. But still, he followed Jesus into this dangerous place. And that says something to me. I think there's something to that. Something that we get kind of hard on Peter. We get kind of rougher about him because of what will happen in the story. But I don't know. There's something in this that I think is somewhat beautiful. Something that we want to remember about him. But we'll come back to him a little later on. Let's keep reading. Verse 55. Inside, the leading priests and the entire high council were trying to find evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death. But they couldn't find any. Many false witnesses spoke against him, but they contradicted each other. Finally, some men stood up and gave this false testimony. "We heard him say, 'I will destroy the temple made with human hands, and in 3 days I'll build another made without human hands.'" But even they didn't get their story straight. We'll stop there for a minute. And I need to interrupt here because we need to have the context for this clearly in our minds. Because remember, this is not Jesus just facing off with some of the local leaders of synagogues like we've seen before in this story up in Galilee. These are not just, community leaders here. This is the Sanhedrin. This is the highest ruling authority in Israel under Rome. It would not be inaccurate to say that this is akin to appearing before the Supreme Court and having to have your case tried there. It's a very big deal that's happening here. But here's the thing. And I believe that Mark wants us to catch the irony of this, as well as all the other gospel writers, because they all include the details of this. There are multiple violations of Jewish law taking place in this trial that we're reading about and that we'll continue to read about here. For starters, right in the Mishnah, it says that capital cases have to be held during the day. If somebody's on trial for their life, it has to take place during the daytime. And then if a person is found guilty, they have to sleep on it. All the judges have to sleep on it in case they may change their minds. And so they have to reconvene the next day to be able to pass sentence. So capital cases cannot be held on the eve. And it's stated explicitly this way in the Mishnah. You can look it up. The capital cases cannot be held on the eve of a Sabbath or on the eve of a festival. And I don't know if you've caught it so far, but this trial is taking place at night on the eve of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which we went over the last time. So it's right on the eve of a festival, everything that they're not supposed to be doing. And I'm not going to bog down going over all of it, but a capital trial in Jerusalem was to be held in the temple precinct, not in an individual's home, even if that individual was the high priest himself. It still had to take place out in the public arena of the temple so that everyone could recognize and see what was happening. According to Deuteronomy 17:6, a guilty verdict for capital punishment had to come with at least two corroborating witnesses. And again, the Mishnah elaborates on this, but if one person said, "Hey, this event happened at the fifth hour of the day," and another one says, "No, it happened at the third hour of the day," their testimonies get dismissed. They don't line up. They had to be corroborated to exact detail. That's why they're having such a struggle here in this trial, because in such a rush to get this trial, nobody was able to get their story straight and figure out how they were going to frame Jesus in this. And it goes on and on. There's a book by Earl Wingo. He was an attorney. He wrote a book called The Illegal Trial of Jesus. And he goes through and points out no less than 18 times that the court violated the law of the Jewish people under the Mishnah and the Old Testament, according to the gospel accounts of Jesus's trial. And that's led some critical scholars to say, well, look, this whole thing's fabricated. How would anybody know what was happening there anyway? And this is just so out of sync with Jewish custom and law that you can't believe it. But I think that just woefully underestimates the human capacity for corruption. I think that anybody who's been around other humans in power before would know that this is highly possible, even probable. But here's another thing. Believing yourself to be a special prophet, which is part of what was happening here with Jesus. This was part of the accusation that he believed himself to be a special prophet. That is not an offense that's punishable by death in ancient Israel. There was really actually no crime in this. Now, to be a false prophet, even under the law of Moses, that was punishable by death, but it had to be proven. There had to be enough evidence to prove that he was a false prophet. That's why the witnesses bring up the temple. That's why they're bringing up this story. Directly speaking against the temple was akin to speaking directly against Israel, which would thereby make you someone who is speaking against the God of Israel. And in John 2, Jesus actually did say something similar to what it is that they mention here in Mark. Jesus said that in the temple area, destroy this temple and I will raise it up again in 3 days. That's the quote that he said, and John elaborates saying he was talking about his own death and resurrection. The people around that wouldn't have known. But even still, the witnesses who are repeating this back twist it into something else. It's not what he said at all, but again, they can't get their story straight. They can't get them to line up, and so they can't use those. Those testimonies get nullified. And the irony that I believe we're supposed to catch in that is that here Jesus is on trial for being a false prophet. And those who are supposed to be upholding God's law are handling that law falsely in order to condemn Jesus illegally. It's a fascinating thing, and I believe it's meant as a revelation to us, because what had happened in Israel during that time, it was way more than just an issue of legalism versus grace or anything like that. The institution, the religious institution of Jesus' day had assumed that they could start using the world's methods to bring about the kingdom of God. And this is meant as a revelation to us as we see the blatant way in which they're abusing the very law they're supposed to be protecting in order to get at Jesus. That religious pride will pursue power at the cost of righteousness. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. Truth was not in the best interest of those who held power in this story, the Sanhedrin. But before we create, two-dimensional caricatures of them, let's understand that they most likely believed that they were doing the right thing. It's not that they set out like we're going to, mess up God's plans here. No, they were trying to their best to protect what they believed was God's good interest. They believed they were operating in the best interests of Israel under Roman occupation. And they likely believed that they were being faithful to God by defending the temple and defending their faith, because Jesus represented a radical departure from the status quo, from the way they understood God and his purposes and his kingdom. And they were holding fast to their traditional beliefs. They were taking a stand for what they believed was right. If they had to employ less than godly measures to do it, well, the end justifies the means. It doesn't matter how we got here and we're defending God. In their religious pride, they believed that maintaining power was an important aspect to being faithful to God. But in this account here, we're reminded that God's a God of truth, of justice, of righteousness, rightness. Those values are important to God, the values that he wants his people to put on display, ones that he wants us to be representing to a broken world. God doesn't need us to employ this broken world's methods in order to defend him. He's well able to take care of himself. The trial of Jesus is meant to remind us that we don't pursue power the way the world does. Our power, as Jesus will show us, comes through sacrifice, not sacred fights we pick over things that we think are sacred. In fact, Jesus shows us his way as the story goes on. Verse 60. Then the high priest stood up before the others and asked Jesus, "Well, aren't you going to answer these charges? What do you have to say for yourself?" But Jesus was silent and made no reply. 600 years earlier, the prophet Isaiah poetically forecast this trial in Isaiah 53:7. He was oppressed and treated harshly, yet he never said a word. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep is silent before the shearers. He didn't open his mouth. Caiaphas, the high priest, obviously is getting frustrated at this point, exasperated by the lack of progress that his own trial is making here. And part of what is ticking him off is Jesus' silence in the midst of all of this. And I'll tell you, put yourself in Jesus' position for just a moment here. You know, you'll say, "Oh, I'm not like Jesus. I can't be like," but do it. That's part of what these gospel stories are supposed to be. We're supposed to step in to the place of these characters. Try this on for size. Some of the most difficult trials that I can think of that I've faced in my life are ones where I feel like I've been misrepresented or accused of something I didn't do. Ever been in that kind of a situation? Someone misrepresents who you are, says something about you that you know is patently false. And what do we want to do in those situations? What's our first impulse?
Anger and defend ourselves.
That's exactly right. We want to get in there and set the story straight and defend ourselves. But I'll tell you, I believe we learn from Jesus when it comes to how it is that we're going to represent the reality of God's kingdom, that sometimes silence can be a very good testimony. Now understand here in this, Jesus is not like pleading the fifth until his lawyers can mount a better case in this whole thing. This was Jesus being confident enough in his Father's rule that he didn't feel compelled to rush to his own defense. And reflecting back on this story many years later, Peter will write this in 1 Peter 2:23. "And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously." There was a singular focus on who was in control of this from Jesus' perspective. It wasn't Caiaphas. It wasn't anybody else in that room that anybody could see. But it was the one who judges righteously. Jesus wasn't compelled to defend every misstatement made about him when he was being opposed. And I think that if we're desiring to be more like Christ in our lives as a new year unfolds, you know, maybe we need to consider silence as a good testimony of our faith in God's rule over things. Maybe especially when it comes to our online interactions, like social media platforms. Maybe we don't have to weigh in on every statement that we disagree with. Just a thought, just something to ponder for a moment. I'm sure you've seen that old cartoon. It's from years ago, but a wife is calling from the bedroom. Are you coming to bed? And a husband is sitting at the computer and he says, "I can't right now. This is important." And she calls back, "What is?" And he says, "Somebody is wrong on the internet." But it seems like we've got this compulsion of late to wade into every statement made online, especially if it relates to a faith or political philosophy. And we justify that thinking by saying, "Well, I got to take a stand. I got to stand for what I believe in. I'm just being a good witness here." But are we really? Are we really? Even then, is what we say really changing minds? Or is it just adding to the noise that's out there? Michael Newman is a Christian blogger that I'll read occasionally. And he said one time, "It seems like now that everyone has a voice, we have all lost our ears." There's something to that. It's just something to think about. Last week when we did our painting and we asked if you wanted to write some things down, I think I have some glasses here and I'm going to need them. But somebody wrote this, and I thought it was really poignant. I really liked it, and I want to share it with you. It says, "As this year unfolds, may we become increasingly still and know that He is God. The world is spinning in wild and weird ways and is out of balance and stumbling. May our stillness reflect the face of God the way that the surface of a still body of water reflects what is above and around it." I love that picture. I love that. And it's something to keep in mind when we look at this trial of Jesus. One of the greater testimonies of this was his unwillingness to engage in the worldly conflict, which was the spirit of the age. Okay, so his silence, though, actually leads to what we would consider the climax of this drama, the big moment here. And it's just the finishing part of verse 61. We left off in the middle of verse 61. So we pick back up and we read the rest of verse 61. The high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" Meaning, are you this Messiah, the Son of God? This is so powerful because Caiaphas has struck out in all of his attempts to try to get Jesus painted as a false prophet by the witnesses that he's pulled together. Everybody's messing up their own stories, and Jewish law couldn't be twisted far enough to find a guilty verdict here. So he goes to the one thing that he know will broaden the scope: get Jesus to claim messiahship. Because Messiah is the term, it's the term for the anointed king, the divine king over Israel. And if Jesus allows himself to be identified as a king, then he is a direct rival to Caesar, and Caiaphas could enlist Rome's help to help execute, to eliminate this Jesus problem. All through Mark's gospel, if you've been here with us and we've been reading all these stories, these encounters that Jesus has had with people, amazing things have taken place. And each time Jesus is constantly, consistently saying, keep this under your hat. Remember, he's constantly saying, don't tell people about this. Don't even talk about it or whatever. Mark carefully avoids having any character in the story identify too specifically who Jesus is, apart from Peter's statement back in chapter 8. And here, in an ironic twist, Caiaphas repeats the same words that Peter says back in chapter 8, just with a question mark at the end. In the Greek, it comes off with as a statement. You are the Messiah? Just like Peter said, you are the Messiah. Jesus' main opposition unwittingly provides the platform for the big reveal of this gospel. The question that Mark has had hanging over all of these stories, all through this narrative, is Jesus the Messiah? Is he the Son of God? Is he the divine king who's going to set all things right? And now, at this moment, Jesus answers the question. Verse 62. Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated in the place of power at God's right hand and coming on the clouds of heaven." And the high priest tore his clothing to show his horror and said, "Why do we need any other witnesses? You've all heard this blasphemy. What's your verdict?" "Guilty," they cried. "He deserves to die." And some of them began to spit at him, and they blindfolded him and beat him with their fists. "Prophesy to us," they jeered. And the guards slapped him as they took him away. The time for the messianic secret is over. It's come to an end. And Jesus answers the high priest with the same covenant name that God gave when Moses asked who it was that was sending him from that burning bush to the Pharaoh's court to release the Israelites. And God spoke and said, "Tell the Israelites, I am, has sent you." Jesus stands now before the legacy of Moses, before the followers of Moses' law, and he declares, "I am," to them. And then he mashes together two messianic prophecies, Psalm 110 and Daniel 7, which basically is declaring that he is the divine king who actually is in authority, and they will see presides in authority over them. And by saying that, he's telling them he wasn't the one on trial this whole time. They were. And it's explosive. I mean, we see how explosive it is, because with that statement, Caiaphas now has the charge that he needs, the accusation that's going to unite all the other religious leaders together, that of blasphemy. He's blasphemed. And when Jesus did finally speak, we notice it wasn't to mount a defense that was going to spring him or clear his name. It actually was a statement that sealed his fate and sets into motion all of the events that would lead to his death on the cross, a death on the cross that each one of us is so dependent on for our eternal life, something that he willingly chose to do. And I think it's another lesson that we learn here, that our best testimony is going to be revealed through sacrificial love, just as Jesus revealed it. Maybe through a willingness to lay down our own rights for the sake of others, like Jesus did here. Maybe that would be a better testimony than all the words that we fling into the ether trying to prove ourselves correct. Maybe a willingness to forgive, like Jesus will do on the cross for the very ones that are putting him there. Maybe that would show off the reality of God's good news better than calling people names who disagree with our convictions. It's stuff to think about. Jesus didn't save the world by winning an argument in court. He won by laying down his own life for those who hated him. That is the way of God's kingdom. That is how his kingdom functions. That is how his kingdom advances. A little thing to note here, and I'm only noting it because I'm sure Mark wanted us to see it, hoping we'd catch the irony of it. When Jesus makes his messianic declaration, it says in verse 63 that to show his horror, Caiaphas tore his robes. No big deal, you may think. I mean, that's what people do when they're upset or they're hurt or they're lamenting or something. You know, that was a Jewish tradition. You tear your clothes, you throw dust on your head. Except that in Leviticus 21:10, it says that the high priest has the highest rank of all the priests. He must never leave his hair uncombed or tear his clothing. It's almost a comedic moment when you look at it like that. In this dramatic show of righteous indignation, he actually disqualifies himself as the high priest by tearing his robes. But it's actually fitting because he was the last high priest that there was. From that moment forward, well, not literally in terms of the way history worked out. We can talk later. But theologically, understanding this from the book of Hebrews, the high priest, who is high priest to all people, not just Israel, is in Jesus, is Jesus Christ for the whole human race. It's a fascinating and almost humorous moment here at the end of this trial. Okay, let's check back in on Peter, see what he's been up to during all of this drama. Verse 66, meanwhile, Peter was in the courtyard below. One of the servant girls who worked for the high priest came by and noticed Peter warming himself at the fire. She looked at him closely and said, "You were one of those with Jesus of Nazareth." But Peter denied it. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. And he went out into the entryway. Just then, a rooster crowed. When the servant girl saw him standing there, she began telling the others, "This man is definitely one of them." But Peter denied it again. A little later, some other bystanders confronted Peter and said, "You must be one of them because you're a Galilean." Peter swore, "A curse on me if I'm lying. I don't know this man you're talking about." And immediately the rooster crowed the second time. Suddenly Jesus' words flashed through Peter's mind. "Before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny three times if you even know me." And he broke down and wept. So while Jesus is standing strong before the Sanhedrin, the highest authority in Israel at that time, Peter is confronted by one individual who had no authority, a servant, and in a patriarchal society, a young girl at that, and he falls apart. In contrast to Jesus, he doesn't stay silent in this. First, he pleads ignorance. "I don't know what you're talking about. I just came here. I don't know what's happening. I don't know. There's a fire." And then he moves away from the girl and obviously away from the light of the fire, goes out to the gate there, and he hunkers down just trying to, you know, stay out of sight or whatever. But it's too late because the girl, you know, pulls out her phone, starts tweeting to everybody, "Hey, one of the Nazarenes is right here in the courtyard. Hashtag gotcha." But Peter, again, he denies it. You know, he's firing back. "I don't know anybody. Hashtag don't know the man." But then they close in, identifying that he's a Galilean, more than likely because in the other gospel accounts, they say by your voice. So it's his speech. It's his accent that's giving him away. You know, it's like trying to use coming from Weewa or something like that and going to New York and trying to pass yourself off as a local. It's not going to work. Just letting you know. But so he's a Galilean. His accent's giving him away. And then he ratchets up his defense, taking an oath that he doesn't know this man. The man that a few hours earlier, he swore he would die rather than let any of these things happen. The rooster crows and Peter weeps, and it's a familiar story, one that highlights Peter's fear and resultant failure. This trial is revealing that Peter's faith was not as strong as he thought it was. And that's an important thing, something that we went over last time, an important lesson to remember, not to become overconfident in our own ability to stand strong, but to keep our hope and our trust in the one who will save us. And that's, I think, what I want to draw from this as well, that we want to learn from Peter here that if our testimony falls short, we need to trust in God's grace to redeem us. And I say that because this isn't the end of Peter's story. Often we focus here on the cautionary aspects of Peter's denial, and it is a cautionary lesson for us about societal fear and the pressures to disassociate from Jesus because of that. But Peter was trying to follow Jesus at a safe distance, and he was waiting to see how all of this could pan out. But when he was pressured, he caved in. That was it. He lied and he denied in an act of self-preservation. And listen, I don't want a show of hands or anything like that, but haven't we all been there? You can show your hands, but we knew. But I can kid with him because he's my friend and I love him. But that's the thing. All of us, we look at Peter's story and it'd be easy for us to shake our heads and say, wow, Peter, what a loser. But we all know that we've been there to one degree or another. We've been in those situations where we found it was a whole lot easier just to disassociate from this whole Christianity Jesus thing than to try to explain why we're as weird as we are. That's one of those things that kind of goes with living in this. And when our faith is falling apart and times are difficult, listen, this is not the time. When we get into those moments, that's when our enemy tries to come in and tries to double down on a voice that says, man, you're no good at this and you've really disappointed God and, maybe you should just give up this whole thing. This is not the time to turn fatalistic and start backing away from any sort of belief in Jesus and his ability to redeem our situation, no matter how messed up it may seem to have gotten. Because, we mess up. Our testimony isn't reflecting God's values sometimes. And we just sort of have a tendency sometimes to just go numb on the whole thing. I've messed it up so badly and I'm just going to bail. I'm just going to quit following all of this stuff. I'm just going to drift away. I'll drift away from gathering with the church and all that stuff. And listen, as a pastor, I've seen this kind of thing way many more times than I want to remember. Someone disappears from meeting with us and I'll reach out and, what's going on? What's happening in your life or whatever? And, I'm just going through some things. And when I get those things sorted out, I'll get back into this. I'll start following God more closely. And that's the last thing we want to do, guys. That's the last thing we ever want to do, to bail out on the only one who can actually stabilize us and bring some sort of sense of redemption to who we are as broken human beings. Sometimes, like in Peter's case, we feel like following Jesus maybe is the reason that we're facing trouble in our lives. I wouldn't be in this mess if I wasn't trying to follow God and please him or whatever. And so it seems like the solution is to kind of back away from Christ and his claims on our lives, just to get a little bit of normalcy in my life, away from all of this other stuff. But we have to remember, we got an enemy at work. When we start thinking, maybe I just need to take a break from hanging out with the church or being so serious about following Jesus, maybe I just need to back away from that for a while, just to kind of pursue my life a little bit. We need to recognize right off the bat, that is not God speaking that to us. And that is not the voice of a redeemed heart speaking that. There's another choice of who it could be. There's an enemy at work. Let's not listen to that. Let's keep close with the only one who can redeem any situation in our lives. He's not embarrassed of us. He's not. We know from the other gospels, particularly John, Jesus gives Peter three chances to express his love for Jesus, to rinse that betrayal out of his mouth. Jesus wasn't embarrassed by Peter. He welcomed him back with open arms, set him up as a leader within his church, gave him a voice that didn't betray or deny Jesus anymore, but actually called to people to come into this fellowship with God, this reconciliation of life with the divine. I mean, trials can reveal that our faith is weaker than we had thought, but if that gets revealed, don't let that be a reason to quit following. Let that be the thing that reminds us that if it weren't for his grace to begin with, I wouldn't make it out the door. I wouldn't make it at all if it weren't for the fact that he loves us so much. He gave his only unique son, that whoever would believe on him would never die, but have eternal life. Because the Father didn't send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but that through him, the world might be saved. That's the God we're dealing with. Don't ever forget that. If we fail, we mess up, we ruin our testimony as far as we can tell, don't let that be the thing that makes us trip away from God and find some other way to forge our identity or life. Make that the point of realization that, man, I need his grace more than I ever could have dreamed. Let that be the revelation of who we are apart from him. Let's trust in the grace of a loving God. Let's allow him to redeem all things in our lives. So here's what we learn from a trial. These are things that get revealed, especially in the trial of Jesus. Let's remember to avoid prideful religion and a desire to control that seeks power at all costs. Let's recognize that our best testimony can come from quiet, sacrificial love as we live our lives in this world. And if our testimony falls apart, let's not run and hide. Let's trust in God's grace to redeem us. Right on?
Right on.
All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, if you will, please. Father, we thank you for the ways in which you're moving in our lives and the things that we experience in this life that are not working together to destroy us, but are, by your will, working together to complete us, to show us the reality of who you are and what we can be in you. So, Father, as we look at Jesus' testimony and we follow his story to its conclusion on the cross, but then whole new beginning through the resurrection, help us to find our identities in what it is that Jesus has done. Help us to be good news people in this world who represent your kingdom through the sacrificial love that we display and put on display. Let that be who we are. And we ask this, Lord, in Jesus' name.